You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
And we're back a little week. We had Easter. And
this is the first time, I think, taking off with the show since we started it.
Yeah.
Maybe a Christmas or something.
I know we put them out like hotcakes.
Hotcakes. And put them out and do it consistent. But y'all, I hope you had a happy Easter with your families. And, it was a beautiful day and all that. And it's time to get down some bloody Angola again.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most famous people that ever came out of Angola.
Yeah, he really is. And the amazing thing to me is unless you're a music fan of jazz music and things like that, you may or may not be aware of the story. Yeah, but he is, in fact, the most famous prisoner to ever come out of Angola. And his story is amazing. So we're going to tell you about him today. And that is, he's known as Lead Belly.
Yep.
And we'll get into kind of why, but I'm going to take y'all back a little bit and we're going to go to 1934, y'all.
A little minute ago.
And this was smack dab in the middle of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. Now, Bloody Angola at that time had about 3,000 inmates housed there. It's, if you'll remember and past stories we've told you, they were in ramshackle camps, basically, and they were on that sprawling 18,000 acres.
Convict guards, and
that's right,
a whole
different time. And they were removed from the effects of the Depression because, hell, let's face it, they were pretty much in Depression type conditions, whether there was a Depression or not.
Yeah, exactly.
So the Great Depression started in 1929. And it didn't end until many years later. So they're smack dab in the middle of that. Now, at that time, 90 employees guarded them, and they used you know, force, as Woody just mentioned, they had shotgun toting convict guards.
Right. And they would lock them up at night, and there was no, you know, sergeants on the dorms and all that back then. And they pushed them on the line in the field during the day and locked them up at nighttime to their own devices.
That's right. And prison foremans at that time, they'd call them captain or boss. Right. Prisoners were, believe it or not, back then they called prisoners old things.
Yeah.
That's what they called them. And no one was really spared when it came to punishment in Angola during that time. Now, also at this time, 130 female convicts were still housed at Camp D, and they worked in the fields along with the men at that time, and floggings at that time. Commonplace. Yeah. Hot boxes.
Yeah, and we told you about that before. Certain amount of lashes for certain things, and they'd have other convicts hold them down while they whooped them.
Yeah. And remember, we talked about the fields where they put them in those hot boxes, and they would open them the next day. They'd be
sitting in the field, and then it's 111 degrees outside, and they put you in a tin box.
Yeah. Now it's 150.
At least.
Yeah. So harsh conditions. And at that time, prisoners died at a rate of 41 per year in 1934.
Almost one a week.
Yeah. Money during that time was appropriated to the prison, and prison officials, you know, there was rumors they were diverting some of that money. Right. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But the daily menu at that time was grits, sweet potatoes, blackstrap syrup.
Yes.
How about that? You ever had blackstrap syrup, Woody?
I have. I had the homemade dark cane syrup.
Yeah.
Like that is basically what they're talking about.
Yeah. Yep. And every single day, all the food obviously grown and served on Angola.
Whatever money they got appropriated.
Yeah.
they were raising their own shit.
The men at that time wore white 12-ounce uniforms sewn by the female convicts, and they would chafe them raw in the scorching Louisiana heat. Yeah. They wore black, hard-soled, heavy shoes made on Angola by the Camp East shoe shop, and they were issued straw farm hats. Nothing else. That's no it. Underwear.
No.
No socks.
Yep.
They didn't even have a belt to keep their pants up.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy.
Now, this is just 1 year, y'all, since Charlie Frazier, who we told you about, and several other convicts from Camp E escaped Angola.
Right, and the reason they developed the red hat cell block.
Yep. The very reason. And there were no visitors allowed in Angola since that escape until 1937. So they went several years.
No, that's a lot. I don't imagine many people back then got visitors anyway.
Yeah.
Because that old road back then in the 30s, it had to be gravel.
And yeah.
It took, you know, once you turned off of 61, it should have taken an hour to get up there or 2 hours.
Yeah.
If you're going by horse.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Good point. And so no visitors were typically allowed. However, a musical historian by the name of John Lomax, he was allowed into Angola in 1934. Now, he was the curator of the Archive of American Folk Songs, and he requested the visit to track down Southern folk music and tour the prison. He was just looking for prison-related work songs, like we used to have as our intro.
Right.
For Angola
Not only that, for when the original Real Life Real Crime, the very first one I found was the Prison Chain Gang song. I don't want to sugar in my coffee.
Yeah, love that song.
This trips me out. Think about that in the 30s. Now, that's not like they had phones that recorded. Or boom boxes or tape recorders. This was some old school shit.
Yeah,
this was to go out and record it. Yeah.
And it was the only thing that made the day pass. Right. I mean, those chain gangs were singing because it just, you know, all you have to focus on is work.
It would help them keep the rhythm, like if they're sling blading or whatever.
Yep.
Everybody, you know, they do it on a certain beat on the upswing, certain beat on downswing. It helps them keep the same rhythm. That way nobody's going faster, nobody's slacking fucking off and going slower.
Yeah.
So the music helped them, you know, pass the day, but more importantly, helped them stay in rhyme with the cutting or whatever work they're doing.
Yeah. Very good point.
Kind of like a military cadence when you left, yep. Right, left, but it's the same thing when they're singing the songs.
Very good. Now, so he goes to visit, and they allow him to for that reason. But at Camp A, he came across more than just songs. He found a black singer guitarist, and this guy actually blew him away, and a lot of other people later on.
Absolutely. And then, so Magic went up there. I mean, you know, I had slipped a warden a 20 or something and say, hey, can I have access? And this is what I'm looking for. There's not a whole lot of really incentive for the warden and the people to just, you know, this guy's not a celebrity.
Right.
You
know, or, yeah, he's a music shit,
the
historian.
Radio hadn't even been around for that fucking long. But so however he got the access and quickly became known, you know, the hottest thing going at Angola was a guy by the name of Huddy Ledbetter. But the convicts called him Lead Belly. And he's a big dude. He was 6 feet tall, but not an ounce of fat, y'all. He had that prison muscle.
We're
talking about. Oh, and yeah. You could only get that. You can't do steroids and get that kind of muscles, right?
Yeah.
So no one could say for sure how old Lead Belly was exactly at this initial meeting. And it's guesstimated he was around 45 years old, y'all. And even Leadbelly didn't know his own age. He was born on a plantation, and his parents were both ex-slaves. So put it in a context. We're talking Civil War ended in 1865, 75, 85, 95, 1965. You're talking about 40, 50 years later.
Yeah.
At the end of the Civil War, right? Yeah. So his parents were both ex-slaves. And when he was 5 years old, his family moved to Texas to work for a black plantation owner named Henry Sims. So let's go back to it again. Look, when Lincoln emancipated the slaves and all that, and the Civil War ended during Reconstruction or whatever, hey, you still had the plantations. Yeah. And the world still had its need for cotton and all these different items that they do. But just because the slaves were freed, you know, They still worked. They still needed to eat.
Yeah.
And so
yeah, you couldn't just say we're free and not make them money.
So they continued, even though they were ex-slaves, it was most of them, I'd say 80%, stayed on these plantations and worked anyway.
It's what they knew how to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And generational, right? So he goes, and he moves to Texas, and they're working for Henry Sims, and they save money. And eventually, Leadbelly's dad purchased 68 wooded acres of land close to Shreveport, Louisiana, y'all. And there, yeah, I'm guessing if you listen to this, you know that's in the far northwestern corner of the state. But get this, y'all. He bought that land, 68 acres, for $2.50 per acre. That's I mean, you can't get an acre for –
That's a lot of money back then, though.
On the Mississippi Louisiana line, yeah, that was in the middle of nowhere, no road frontage or whatever, and they want 6,500 acre for it.
Yeah,
that was a lot of money back then, though. You're right.
So, and obviously they probably saved that money for.
Yeah.
I mean they might have been making $2.50 a day.
And they didn't have it in a savings account. It was as bad as an old tin can hidden under a mattress or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but and you're right. His dad chopped trees, and his mom cleared the brush, and they built a home. And they turned it into their own working farm.
Yeah,
right? So, as a kid, Leadbelly learned to play the guitar from his uncle, and he was a natural, y'all, and he played well enough that word got around. And at 15 years old, he would play on Shreveport's Fannin Street, which was a really bad part of town, filled with whorehouses and bars and just
kind of like Bourbon Street.
Kind of like Bourbon Street, yeah. But a whole lot more illegal, you know, back then there wasn't the kind of policing and the shit that they have now. But 15 years old, he's out there, he's playing because he's making money.
Sure.
All right.
And young.
So, right, right. So, in a, like you, you know, you can imagine, being on Fannin Street was not the best influence for him, right? Or especially as a young teenager. And he would play each bar on down on Fannin Street for 50 cents and all the alcohol he could drink.
That sounds like a good deal.
It's like a good time. At 15, yeah. And, but by the time he was 16, he was married and had a kid.
Oh, look at how he led better.
He was making it happen early. Right? 15 years old. But he was a big kid. I mean, you know, you hit that puberty.
And you're running a fast life.
Right, right. I mean, and like I said, he got, you know, he's a pretty big dude. Yeah. So he, by 15 or 16, he would have reached, you know, the end of his puberty. But so, you know, he kind of became famous. You know, I mean, his name got out there, and he continued to rise in popularity, and he moved back to Texas, where he met a blues singer and a guitarist by the name of Blind Lemon Jefferson.
There you go. Right? Look, that's my favorite part of these historic stories.
And so
Blind Lemon
Jefferson took a shine to him, and they struck up a friendship, and they started performing together.
Okay,
right?
So yeah.
Now you got Blind Lemon Jefferson, who was already famous in his own right, and Huddy Ledbetter. And, you know, fairly quickly, Ledbetter soon became known as the king of the 12-string guitar.
Well, I'll be there.
So he had a natural talent. Obviously, he didn't go to guitar school, right?
Right.
And now he's teamed up with a streetwise, another famous blues singer. And, I mean, his fame just rose.
Yeah.
Right? Married with kids.
But as we mentioned, he's living pretty hard, pretty violent. Mm-hmm. You know, he had an attitude. He was a bigger guy. Didn't even, you know, even before he was in prison, he was built. And he would fight pretty much at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's what, you know, y'all, he's not playing, you know, nice clubs. But yeah. Daddy would always call them juke joints.
Yeah.
And juke joints. Yeah, you know, back then there was a lot of disdain, if you will, for alcohol and stuff like that. But it seemed like everybody went to the bad side of town to the juke joints where they were playing and drank, whites and blacks, and drank and partied. But look, there was no law. And if you looked at somebody the wrong way, almost like being in prison, they would fight. And they would kill you. They'd cut you, shoot you. Saturday Night Special. That's where the term came from. Is the little cheap ass pistols that they would use in the juke joints. Fights would break out, and they would kill each other. And it was a throwaway gun.
There you go. Well, he was ready. He was down, as they say. Right. Weapons or no weapons, he would fight either way. And most of his trouble, though, it came from jealous lovers and husbands.
Because old Ledbetter was hot.
Because old Ledbetter was running it.
And made them women move. Yeah, with that man. Music, boy, they were
getting
down.
Played them blues. He got them singing. So a lot of husbands would come after him, and he actually came close to getting killed on many occasions. Now, one of these situations led Huddy to killing a man in 1918. And he was sent to Texas State Prison for that murder.
Right.
Now, he managed to survive, which that Texas prison, that was harsh. It was not quite bloody Angola, but it was pretty close. Yeah. And it had a reputation, actually, for being a little bloody Angola, if you will, primarily due to his name in the blues community. His stardom led him to play for the Texas governor, a guy by the name of Pat Neff, right, in 1925. And it was that particular instance that led to Neff doing what? Issuing a pardon to Ledbetter, right, just before leaving office to make Ledbetter a free man. So he gets out of prison even after killing a man, which at that time, you're lucky if you don't get strung up, right, you know, for that, which is what they did back in those days. But the prison stint, it didn't do a whole lot to calm down Huddy. And he ended up with three more dangerous altercations just a few years after his release from prison.
I mean, being sent to prison back then, as now, there was no reform stuff, in, I call them like universities.
Yeah.
Criminals, right? I mean, you go in, you weren't hard when you go in, you're going to be hard when you come out.
and Huddy was hard. And so he had a few altercations. Now, that first altercation led to a skull fracture from a bottle being cracked over his head. Huddy was so tough that the fracture was not even discovered until many years later. Wow. Literally fractured his skull with a bottle and he didn't even know it. Yeah, he just, you know, years later they found that out. Now, in his second altercation, he was playing a bar when he was attacked by a man with a knife. And the man actually sliced half of Huddy's neck before Huddy Ledbetter's girlfriend at the time fought the man off. This left Leadbelly with a pretty horrendous scar.
Yeah.
Look, medical back in those days,
right,
wasn't what it is now.
Cosmetic surgery to fix
the scar. Yeah. Yeah, especially when you're a former prisoner. Right. I mean, you know, it's like, give me some thread and you put four stitches and hopefully it'll stop bleeding. So the third altercation is one that really got him in trouble. And that took place while in Louisiana. So after a fight in which he claimed that six men tried to steal whiskey from his lunch pail, you always have that in your lunch pail. Leadbelly was convicted of assault with intent to commit murder. Now, court records show that he was convicted of assaulting a white Salvation Army officer with a knife at a Salvation Army concert after the officer told Leadbelly to stop dancing to the music. So in 1930, Leadbelly gets sentenced to 10 years at Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. And authorities discovered, or after they discovered, his prior conviction for murder, he was disqualified for any chance of early release. Right. So they basically said, you're sentenced to 10 years, you're going to serve all 10. So as you can imagine, life at that time, what we told you earlier, it wasn't easy in bloody Angola. And Leadbelly will receive some pretty harsh beatings from the staff at that time for pretty minor offenses. But he adapted to the conditions in Angola, and eventually he was allowed to work as a laundryman and a waiter. So he would actually wait on the staff, on the staff of the prison. During his prison term, it was interesting in the research to find out he had the habit of sleeping with the lights on even when he left prison.
Right.
Like he could not sleep with the lights off.
Yeah.
In Angola, not much more is known except for that Leadbetter worked, he conned, and he fought to survive. One story suggests that Leadbelly was attacked by another inmate and stabbed in the neck for the second time in his life.
Can't kill him.
Other inmates who witnessed that fight said Leadbelly pulled the knife from his neck and returned the attack, almost killing the assailant.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
Let me tell you, if I stab someone in the neck and they pull it out, start coming at me, I'd have messed up.
Right.
And I'm sure they knew that. The fighting continued in Angola up until the day when Lomax discovered him in 1934.
Yep. And so, y'all, you know, when Lomax heard about him and then, you know, you got to hear the king of the 12-string guitar and all that. So, Lomax loved it, right? And he developed a plan to have Leadbetter record a song about Governor O.K. Allen. And Lomax, I mean, obviously they recorded. Y'all know there was no studios. It's like the old record players that did the reverse thing, right? But they recorded it, and he sent it to the governor along with a letter asking, hey, governor, look how talented this dude is. Can you show him some mercy, give him some clemency? And Governor Allen liked it so much that he was like, shit, this dude is wasting his talent. And he released him, y'all. Governor Allen was like, I mean, this is impressive, and Lomax is advocating for him, and, you know, we'd hate to see somebody could play like this and sing like this, because, look, he was supposed to be the best ever at the time. But, you know, he got out, and basically he sung his way out of prison for the second time.
Second time.
I mean, he did it for the governor in Texas, right? But Leadbelly wasn't done with his problems and getting into trouble just yet, y'all. And in 1939, Lead Belly was arrested for assaulting a man with a knife.
That's how he handles his problems. And,
y'all, he stabbed the man 16 times.
Killed him good.
So, but I don't know the guy died, but Lead Belly was convicted of third-degree assault, and he was sentenced to less than a year in prison. Must not have been a very good victim, right? He was around 51 years old at the time, y'all, and he began serving his fourth prison sentence in 1939. And by 1940, after serving 8 months, he was released, and he traveled up to New York City.
New York City.
And about this time, a folk music company was, an up-and-coming thing in New York City, and it just absolutely exploded and had tremendous growth during and after World War II. Because y'all got to remember, that's kind of how the music was back then.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
That's right.
Swing music and what have you.
Oh, yeah.
So, Alan Lomax... again, the one who recorded and sent him to Governor O.K. Allen, he helped Lead Belly with his legal fees in exchange for being able to record an album of him, because he knew Lead Belly was a shit.
Yeah, and look, Lomax, it sounds like, oh, he's such a nice guy. He's helping out Lead Belly. He ain't a nice guy. Yeah. He's trying to use Lead Belly.
Those people are still getting paid off of Lead Belly.
That's right. And, so he did. He helped him with those legal fees, and the rest is history, y'all. Lomax took Ledbetter on the road, and he became absolutely one of the most famous blues and folk musicians of all time. Now, 5 years after leaving Bloody Angola, he was singing in Carnegie Hall. Imagine that. You go from the world's worst prison to singing in Carnegie Hall. 10 years later, he was singing in Paris. He cleaned up his act and was known as one of the sharpest dressers in music. Something he was kind of known styling, for. Right? Yeah. I'm known as the sharpest dresser in podcasting. So Lomax may appear, as I said, to be a savior to old Lead Belly. But it's said Lead Belly often had to perform menial tasks for Lomax. He would shine his shoes and do his laundry. Yeah. Imagine that.
Yeah.
This guy singing in Paris and then shining the shoes of his manager. Yeah. Lomax also took 2/3 of Ledbetter's earnings as his cut for managing and promoting him. Mm-hmm. Wow. Sadly, y'all, maybe some people may say, he's a murderer. Lead Belly died, but he died of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
That's crazy.
Just a horrible, awful way to go. That was on December 6th of 1949. They estimate him to be around 60 years old at that time.
Yeah.
And it was ironic that 8 months after Lead Belly's death, his biggest hit surfaced, a song he opened his concerts with for years, and it was entitled "Good Night, Irene." Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard that song. My mother used to sing me that song when I was a baby to go to sleep.
Yeah.
The song was re-recorded by a band called the Weavers. That's how it was discovered 8 months after his death. And the title sold over 2 million copies.
Yeah, that's a lot
during that time.
Back then, yeah.
So you may wonder, what was some of his most popular songs? "Good Night, Irene," obviously, would be the top. "Midnight Special" was another one. Mm-hmm. "Where Did You Sleep Last Night?"
Yep.
Another one. I remember that song. "The House of the Rising Sun."
Yep. Imagine that.
"Pick one. A Bale of Cotton."
Yep.
Was one.
Yep.
And "Black Betty."
Yeah. Well, let me tell you a couple more real quick. All right. And this is how Lomax made money. And the... Yeah, it's just some of these are crazy, y'all, but they are his songs. "Good Morning Blues" or "Irene Goodnight," like you said, "Midnight Special." Here's one, World War II song, obviously. It's named "The Hitler Song."
The Hitler
Song.
And wow.
I have it right here. I should play it. Then the Boll Weevil,
That's the bow of weevil. The
bugs,
yeah.
The bugs and cotton, yep. Right? Bring me a little water, Sylvie. There is a man going around taking names. Take a whiff on me.
Take a whiff on right? you.
Black Betty.
Yeah.
Alabama Bound. Cotton Fields. The Bourgeois Blues. Yeah. And When I Was a Cowboy. The Gallus Pole. Looky Yonder, Black Betty. And like you said, Let It Shine on Me. And then Ha Ha This Way. And We're in the Same Boat, Brother. Black Girl. Rock Island Line. They Hung Him on the Cross, a little religious music. Looky, Looky Yonder. Bring a Little Water, Sylvie. Yes, I Was Standing in the Bottom. John Hardy. Scottsboro Boys. And the Mr. Hitler again. And then the Gallows Song.
Yeah. So, and if you notice those titles, y'all, those are things he experienced in his
right,
life.
Right.
Well, it's not like now where you have someone write your song.
That's what the blues is about.
Yeah.
If you ever listen to it, it's about the pain and in the stories about life.
And
I always love the blues, by the way.
Me as well. And he was one of the best at it. Yeah, he wrote all his own music. And in 1988, y'all, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And that is the story of Lead Belly.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. His music lives on.
It sure does.
Super, super cool. And it's talking about loving the blues. I used to go to Tabby's Blues Box.
Yeah.
It was downtown Baton Rouge in like the rough, rough part of town.
Yeah.
But he was one of my daddy's clients. And every time I'd go in with my friends, you know, he'd have me sit at his table and stuff like that. And B.B. King, all these guys came around, after Lead Belly.
Yeah.
And just either you love it or you hate it, I guess.
And a lot of them were inspired by his music. Right. And that's
it all grew from that, really.
Yeah.
So
yeah. What an awesome guy he was as far as his music's concerned, yeah. But not a very nice guy outside of that, according to the history.
Different
anyway.
Time coming up on his history. And
yeah.
Else.
That's
he
right.
Lived his life and died from ALS. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Man. I don't get him any other way.
Yeah.
I wonder how, the king of the 12-string guitar, think about that, how hard it is to play a 12-string guitar.
Right.
I mean, that's some.
But his uncle taught him when he was younger, but I'm sure he mastered it, kind of self-taught. Right. And just a lot of people
how he made his living.
Can just play by ear. And
right.
my daughter's plays the flute like no other.
Right.
And she can just pick it up and play.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. She can write her own music. And some people just have that talent, man. You put me behind a guitar, I can strum it. That's about it.
Yeah. Lead Belly. And we'll bring y'all some more on him. Jim and I are going up to Bloody Angola for a tour. And I know they have stuff on him in the museum and stuff like that. But the interesting. I think back to what you were saying about Camp D and the women being housed there. And I told you I said this before, but my grandfather was the first parole officer to live on the B-line. When he was there, my grandmother actually served as a correctional officer over women.
Oh,
and
wow.
So it would have been Camp D. Crazy thing is, Camp D, when I went to the academy at Angola, Camp D is where we lived. And we lived in a dormitory, just like the convicts, that 5 days a week. You got to go home on weekends.
Yeah.
You get up in the morning. I always take my showers in the morning. Get up in the morning, shower, go eat breakfast with the convicts. In the convict mess hall. It was mostly trustee camp by then. But you eat right there at the tables with the convicts.
How was the food?
I never had a problem with the prison food.
Really?
I mean, I actually thought shit was pretty good.
Really?
Especially, I'm single and 20 years old or 21 years old or whatever. And I'm getting three hots and a cot.
Yeah.
And the dormitories, remind me years later when I was in the military or a couple of years before when I was in the military. You walk in, it's this massive room with these steel bunks.
Yeah.
And you had your locker at the bottom, just like the convicts do.
Wow.
And where you put your stuff in and you go to class all day long. Wow. In the same building, and shit, the convicts are just walking around freely.
And what were they teaching in the class?
Everything from CPR to how to look out for suicides to doing counts, you know, how to look out for contraband, how to do searches and seizures, and just the anything you could think of that you would have to do or possibly come in contact with as a correction officer. Everything from sex, and don't do it with the inmates and shit like that. how was a different society and culture when you went through those gates, and it is.
Yeah.
I told you the air doesn't even smell the same.
Yeah.
And, the history and everything else.
I'm sure it's similar to, like, y'all, when you walk into to this studio where we actually record the room. I get told all the time for people that have never been here, when I shut that door, you can actually feel the air. Right. It almost feels like it's airtight.
It does.
It's a whole different sound. And I would imagine when you describe the smell, it's very similar.
Well, you hit a cell block or a dorm. You know, the dormitories, like when you walk in the bathroom, There's no private stalls. It's half walls, and you literally, if I'm sitting here taking a shit and you're next to me, I can say, "Hey, Jim, how you doing?" There's no privacy in the showers or anything like that. There's no privacy anywhere.
Yeah.
You're being watched all the time.
Wow.
You know, it's just a different way. I mean, go to like basic training for the Army, but they teach you basic Army stuff.
Yeah.
How to be a soldier. To the law enforcement academy to become a police officer, they teach you the basics of being a cop.
Right.
When you go to the correctional, and I'm assuming it's still there, the academy, that's what it was, at Angola, they taught you everything, the basics of what you needed to know to be a correctional officer and survive. But the one thing they also taught you, just like they taught me in the law enforcement academy at LSU, when you graduate and you go get that on the job training, they tell you, forget about everything you just fucking learned.
Yeah.
Because now I'm going to teach you what the real shit's about.
Right. Yeah.
This is how it really works.
That's right. Yeah. And so, that's exactly what they do.
But shout out to those people to get it done, especially the trainers who, I mean, usually the most senior people in, who've risen it throughout their career and
sure.
the name for themselves. And they go in there and have the time and the patience to teach these other people, because even in law enforcement, and I hate to say this, but some of 99% of the best people, then you just got some fucking morons.
Yeah. Every profession.
You know, this dude's going to get it swung. He's not going to make it. Or they're going to be bringing in dope. You see all these correctional officers getting arrested all the time for bringing in dope and cell phones or having sex with inmates and shit like that.
You got that, unfortunately, in every profession. And you mentioned CPR, and it just reminded me of something, because my wife has to get recertified every year. And we were talking about this the other night. I try to stay up with it, obviously. I have her teach me. I'm not technically certified. Yeah. But it has changed so much in the last 20. It used to be like 7 to 1. Yeah, you know, you'd do 7 compressions to 1 breath. Y'all, now it's like 30 to 1.
Man, that's crazy, because I saw that they had changes in that. The
major.
Not only CPR, but it'd be like first aid. I'll tell you what, one of the ones that's popping my mind now, what to do during a riot. And the first thing, if they took you hostage, you would try to put a human face on yourself, say, "Hey, I have a family, I have a wife, I have kids," whatever. And, try to bring out the humanity in the person who was kidnapping you or holding you hostage, all the way up to the point if you were getting fucking going to get raped, the very last resort, guess what it was?
What?
Shit on yourself. Try to shit or piss on yourself to stop them to turn
really?
Off from raping you. Yeah, this is shit. And they make you sign a thing stating, law enforcement too, they're stating that they tell you, like on the first day, if you can't kill a motherfucker, you're in the wrong room. And you have to sign a form stating that you were willing to use deadly force if necessary. Even if, I mean, in the tower, motherfuckers running, you fire the warning shot and then he shoots a stop, but you might kill him, right?
Right.
But if you were a correction officer and you were taking somebody down to charity hospital in New Orleans and they ran in the city, you didn't have to fire the warning shot.
Yeah.
You just shot them. And I saw one of Burl Cain's interviews. He was like, well, yeah, you know, they got to fire the warning shot and then they got to shoot to stop them. But who's to say where they're going to hit them at with a shotgun?
Yeah.
You know? So like you said, there's just all kinds of crazy shit. And people don't think about correctional officers like that on that scale, but they really are trained and they have professionals in there. That's their life career. And they've been doing it for generations and not just in there drawing a paycheck, but of course you have some shitheads that are,
always.
But shout out to them. Cause you know what? If they didn't do it. I mean, hey, you go in that motherfucking gate and you're in there, you're outnumbered, however many hundreds to one, you got no weapon.
Yeah.
You've got nothing but your training and your experience. And I'm gonna tell you something, and anybody who says different is doesn't know what they're talking about. Convicts run a prison.
Yeah.
And it's all about simply if they ever got together in any given moment, and has been proven by past riots, et cetera, if they ever come together as one collective mind,
mm-hmm.
they turn that motherfucker out. There's not a prison in this world that can't be taken over.
Yeah.
Yeah. But convicts, difference between convict and inmate, convict is a person who's down for a long time. They don't want to buck the system. They like their routine. They like their privileges and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they don't want to fuck anything up. Right.
Yeah.
And so they're the ones that kind of keep the smooth, even keel on the thing. Now, inmate is young bucks that come in and always fighting and fucking and dealing with the dope and fighting guards or COs and stuff like that. And then, like we said before, either you can do your time or let your time do you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And those correctional officers, even though they're not behind bars, they pretty much are. I mean, they're working these long shifts.
I felt like I was doing time with them.
Yeah.
And 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And look, 12 on, 12 on, 12 off, 12 off, 12 on three times. 12 off two times, and then 12 on three times, right?
Yeah.
They were always shorthanded. They had an on-call list that came out every 2 weeks, whatever it was. And if your fucking name was on the on-call list, you were getting called in. You could just book on it. I didn't mind when I was young because I was fucking making a killing, right?
Yeah.
They were making more than probably minimum wage back when I was doing it. But it got to the point where I hadn't had a day off in months. That I tell them to sign me up. And the only way you can could not go in was even a young man likes to have his time off and they're not married and running the streets, et cetera. But they called and you say, hey, you know what? Sorry, I'm fucked up. And that's what I did. And it, or Swim did. So I'm fucked up. And he said, what do you mean? So I'm sorry. I've been drinking. Yeah, I can't drive in. Right. And because if they tell you then that you got to drive in, actually an old timer taught me that trick. So they tell you that you got to drive in then and you get in a wreck.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. Now what he's saying, not saying he's lying. He probably was.
Or I wanted to be.
Yeah. And then as you know, and you don't think about that with not only your correctional people, but your law enforcement officers in general you're kind of always on call because you're always shorthanded, especially these days. And these guys, a lot of them like to hunt.
Yeah.
You know, you might be in a tree stand and
right.
Right. And your phone's going off.
I've had it. I can't tell you how many times I've been hunting or fishing or whatever, and that fucking pager goes off. It used to be a pager.
Yeah.
Pager goes off, and then you're fucking done.
Well, especially when you're a detective.
Yeah, that was even worse. Guaranteed you any time there was a holiday or an anniversary or a birthday, anything that meant something to you, or graduation in your personal life, some fucking asshole was going to kill somebody or rape somebody, and you're getting called out.
Which is one
of the reasons I went to the state police, because that was probably the biggest enticement for me was they said, look, you come over as a criminal investigator, you'll have no more of your own cases. No more nights, no more weekends. You know,
yeah.
You only get sent out if somebody else requests help.
Right. So, and how many detectives, when you were at the LPSO, how many detectives did y'all have?
At Livingston, we had 8 detectives for everything from theft of a garbage can to murder.
Really?
Everything.
Wow, that's surprising.
And now they have, Jason Art has just divisions and divisions, like burglary units and major crime units and whatever. Fuck, they got a detective for everything now, or a division, which is great.
Yeah, it keeps you guys from getting burned out.
We got fucked, and it's not Willie Gray's fault, but his daddy was the sheriff for him, but he was never a detective. Now Jason R. came up and he served his time in detectives too.
Yeah,
so he understands the pressure of it. Every report they got written in by every deputy in the whole parish got referred to a detective. Yeah, wow. Every day you walked in, you had a fucking stack of your reports like this. You know what you did? You read it. It had the fence on top and whatever. If they didn't have a suspect, put that motherfucker in round 5.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. I mean, you didn't even call them back. Just had me. You got it today.
Interesting.
And correction officers the same way. I mean, shit. That was, you know, they got their own investigators. That's. It's just like a police force almost.
Yeah.
And you know, CERT teams like the SWAT teams and all that.
So well, it's come such a long way since your time there and just the funding for police departments overall has increased so much, thankfully. Yeah. And you're able to hire more and more detectives because look, burnout is what leads to cases not getting solved sometimes. Yeah. You can't do them all to the consistency that you want to do them in because there's so many and there's only a limited amount of people investigating.
You know, I used to say squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Yeah.
And motherfucker didn't call in and ask about the case.
And that's a true statement.
If you have a suspect, then I don't have time to fuck with it.
Yeah. Right?
Now, anyway, store for another day.
Very interesting. Very interesting. But, well,
that'd be interesting. His music's online. You can YouTube it and do whatever.
Yeah, check him out.
I'm going to listen to the Mr. Hitler song. Yeah. I'll leave here today. See what he had to say.
I'm definitely
Hitler.
Curious to hear that one. For sure. And boll weevil.
Yeah.
Right. It's got to be
about
a good
picking
one.
Picking that cotton in the field.
Yeah. Thank you to all our patrons. Obviously.
Yeah. I was about to say patrons. We love y'all and you make this show run. We appreciate it. We will be getting you another episode coming up. I got something I'm looking at. But thank you. And if you're not a patron member, you want to be, you get all these locked up bonus episodes and all these different things, perks and benefits according to the different tier levels. But go to patreon.com and type in Bloody Angola or.
That's right. You can go to Apple Podcast Connect.
That's right.
Yeah. Apple Podcast is weird. They're not like Patreon in that they don't have tier levels, but you will get early release episodes.
Commercial free
on that platform. So if Apple's your thing, check that out. If Patreon's your thing, check that out. Got some monthly gifts going out here pretty soon. So those go out to our warden team members, which is the top tier level. We send them something quarterly. So that quarterly gift will be heading your way soon. I'm just waiting for it to get made.
Yeah.
Thank you very much to all of y'all.
Love and appreciate each and every one of y'all.
That's right. And until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Everton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola.
Podcast, 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang. wrangle the three.